September 17th. Two more games off the schedule. Boston's three-game series with the hapless Devil Rays, the last time the Red Sox will see them at home this year, is concluded. The Sox won games 2 and 3. Father Kurt stood up to the curse of Sports Illustrated last night by remaining in the game until the 8th, with a three-hit shutout until a Rocco Baldelli home run in the 6th, and becoming the first pitcher in the majors this year to win 20 games. The man is a horse, no doubt about it, but he's also had the kind of run support he almost never saw in his Diamondback days, and there's no doubt about that either. His teammates, who have provided him with a staggering number of runs per start, footnote, 9 is the number that comes to mind, but you know what old Case said. You could look it up. Last night, staked him to 3 in the first, and 8 more by the time he left to a standing O. Wakefield's start 2 nights ago was a smellier kettle of fish. I purposely stayed away from this manuscript when it was over, because any words I wrote would have begun harshly. This team is almost ready for postseason, where they will become some better club's stepping stone. Tim Wakefield did not figure in the decision and looked terrible for the third outing in a row. The talking heads have begun to speculate that Terry Francona may go to a 4-man rotation in postseason, and that if he does, Wake will be the odd man out. This may or may not happen. But the simple fact of Boston's 8-6 win over Tampa Bay on the evening of September 15th was that almost every pitcher Francona sent to the mound in Wakefield's wake, with the sole exception of Keith Falk, who pitched a 1-2-3 ninth, looked terrible. There may not be a curse of Sports Illustrated. I'll wait and see on that one. But there certainly is a curse of middle relief in the big leagues. And once you get past Mike Timlin, and maybe Alan Embry. The Red Sox also suffer from the disease. I've rarely gone to bed after a win feeling as unhappy and unsettled as I did after that game on the 15th. Usually, when I can't sleep, what I see are key plays that went against my team. Jorge Posada's flare of a single against Pedro in Game 7 of the 2003 ALCS, for instance. What I kept seeing after that second game against Tampa Bay, a game we probably deserved to lose, was Curtis the Mechanic Lescanic shaking his head after giving up the 2-run dinger that allowed the hapless D-Rays to pull even, 6-6, late in the game. "Why are you shaking your head?" I wanted to scream at him. "This is a team filled with weak hitters, Punch and Judy hitters. But they're still major league hitters, my friend, and if you hang one, it's going out of the yard. What's so hard to figure out about that?" Never mind, I tell myself. That night's ugly piece of work and Father Kurt's thing of beauty last night are both going to look the same in the win column at the end of the year. Meanwhile, we're just 3.5 games out of first. And tonight, it's Yankees-Red Sox.
I really don't expect to get this one in with the train of Hurricane Ivan due, but there's been such hype and that rarity, an actual capacity crowd at the stadium, not just a paper sellout, thanks to us, that George will do whatever it takes to play it. In the third, there's a rain delay. From their cozy Nesson studios, Tom Caron and Eck gush over highlights from the last Yankee series in Fenway. Here's the Tech A-Rod tiff, and Bill Miller's walk-off shot against Moe, tape we've seen hundreds of times already. In 15 minutes, we're back, though it still seems to be spinning. And then a few outs later, it's pouring, and here comes the tarp. TC and Eck babble for a good 20 minutes before resorting to canned stuff. And what canned stuff should they run first but Steve himself, dispelling the curse and telling us where he was in 78 and 86 and 03 when the roof caved in. In 86, he's in his car outside his place in Western Maine, because that's the only reception he can get. He's sitting there with the door open and an unopened bottle of champagne on the seat beside him. Now that's a storyteller, putting you right there with just the right details. You know it's a serious rain delay when Nesson cuts to the nature shows. At least it's not Canadian football.
And so, like Yates's great rough beast, the rivalry has once more come round at last. Footnote: I am allowed to say stuff like this because, according to John Cheever, the Belle Lettre version of Old Case, All literary men must be Red Sox fans. My reputation as a literary man is actually in some dispute, but I am a man, a Red Sox fan, and a writer, so fuck it. I think Norman Mailer said that in The Naked and the Dead. The Red Sox are in New York for three. I'm here for the middle game, and so is Stuart Onan. Between publicity for Faithful, not to mention work on the book itself, which I am now doing, and more publicity for the children's version of The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, I expect to be immured in hardball until I go back to Maine on Monday night. With that in mind, I decided I would take Friday night off entirely and give my nerves a rest. I decided to go to a movie. Something with subtitles. The sort of thing that never plays at the North Conway Sixplex or the Bethel Station Fourplex back home. And then return to my hotel, where I'd go straight to bed without even checking the score, lest I be sucked in. I thought the Sox would probably lose the opener anyway. With the exception of the August streak, they have made a career of losing openers this season, it seems. And I could read about it in the New York Times the following day. Not the Post. The Post is simply too gloaty when the hometown teams win. Well, I didn't exactly give my nerves a rest. I saw an extremely nervous-making French suspenser called Red Lights. But my plan remained on course until I got back to my hotel at around 10 p.m. Then everything fell down. And why, you ask? Because the Yankees-Red Sox rivalry is simply in the air if you happen to be in one of those two cities, and especially if you happen to be in the one where the games are being played. Oh, it's maybe not a big deal among the sort of people who flock to see French suspense movies with white subtitles that are almost impossible to read when superimposed on white backgrounds, as at least 60% of these seem to be. But when I got back to the hotel, the doorman took a look at my T-shirt, a gift from Stuart Onan. It features a picture of David Ortiz and reads, "I love it when you call me Big Poppy," and greeted me with, "Hey, Mr. King, welcome back. Your Sox are up one zip in the third." One of the car park guys joined us at that moment, favored me with a rather loathsome smile. If it was supposed to project sympathy, it failed miserably and said, "Nah, it's tied. 1-1. Then the house detective, for whom I'd signed a book earlier, came out through the revolving doors. "Nope," he said. "It's 2-1 Yanks. Olerud just homered." So much for my resolution. 5 minutes later, no, three, I was sitting in my room with my Red Sox cap out of my suitcase and on my head, watching the game. Now, the players, some of them at least, will try to tell you that a match like this is just another game, and that if it is more important, it's because of the lateness of the season and the swing, first playing second. Few, if any, of them actually believe such nonsense. You can see it in their eyes during their locker room interviews, and you can certainly see it in the level of play they bring to the field. Footnote. Tanyan Sturts, for instance, lately miserable in middle relief for the Yankees, he went 2/3 of an inning in his last appearance, was utterly brilliant last night. Yankees-Red Sox is a classic rivalry. Last night's game was one of the best in it I've ever seen, and I only saw it from the fifth inning on. If not for two rain delays totaling almost an hour and a half, almost exactly the length of my foreign film, I probably would have missed the whole damn thing. And I'm so glad I didn't miss all the excitement in an effort to spare my nerves another jolt of what I was sure they would have to endure. Rivera successful. Yankees triumphant. The part I did miss was Johnny Damon's upper deck shot to put the Red Sox ahead 1-0. I also missed chortling gleefully over how George Steinbrenner must hate all that hair flying gaily in the wind as Damon rounds the bases, and the Ramirez show. First the Shakespearean non-homer. Fair was foul, after all. And then the sensational Air Manny catch that robbed Miguel Cairo of his own home run. The fun of that one, of course, every bit as good on the replays, was watching Cairo run the bases in absolute surety that he'd hit the ball out, and his blank look of amazement when he was informed, after slapping the bemused third base coach's hand on his way home, that he'd been out during his whole tour of the base paths. I was there, however, by then in my underwear but still wearing my David Ortiz t-shirt and my Red Sox hat, when Mariano Rivera came in to seal the deal with the Yankees leading 2-1 in the top of the ninth. That he's one of the great ones, there can be no doubt. Johnny Damon says flatly that Rivera is the greatest closer of all time. But he has problems with the Red Sox. Bill Miller touched him hard for a two-run walk-off home run in the July rhubarb game at Fenway. And last night, Rivera blew the save with one out and then blew the game with two out. You didn't have to be a lip reader to see what he was yelling at center fielder Kenny Lofton when Damon's broken bat flare, another of those dying quail shots that seemed to have decided so many games between these two clubs, dropped 10 or 12 feet in front of Lofton on the wet grass. Catch the ball! But in fact, Rivera had no one to blame but himself, or the Red Sox, who simply wouldn't quit and let Rivera pick up his 50th save in peace. The Yankee closer walked Trot Nixon, who was replaced by the speedy Dave Roberts. Then he hit Kevin Millar, who was replaced by the fairly speedy Gabe Kapler. With two on and one out, I expected a game-ending double play. Instead, Orlando Cabrera singled through the hole into right. Kevin Youkilis followed with a strikeout. I love Uke, but he was simply overmatched in the ninth last night. Then came Damon, and ballgame. You would say that tomorrow's game, assuming the remains of Hurricane Ivan don't wash it out, couldn't possibly measure up. But with these two teams, I'm afraid to say anything but this. It's going to be another game off the schedule. And last night we maintained our good hold on the wild card. The gap between us and the Yankees for the top spot in the AL East has, meanwhile, once more shrunk to a mere 2.5 games.
Like happy families, all blown saves are alike. You overthrow and leave the ball up and out and walk the leadoff guy. Get behind the second guy and hit him. Miss your location and a 260 hitter goes the other way on you. And your right fielder with the best arm on the team throws one up the line so their speedy pinch runner scores. Next guy bloops one that your center fielder usually gets. But this time, for no other reason than things are going to hell, he pulls up and the ball drops, another run scores, and you've just blown another save. Closers blow saves. That's just a fact of baseball. Yankee fans will say that Mariano Rivera doesn't. But here's proof, again, that it doesn't matter if you're Moe or John Wayback Wasdin or the old Derek Lowe or Eric Gagne or Eck in his prime. Closers blow saves. You just hope they aren't important ones, like Game 7 of the World Series. Oh, sorry, Moe. September 18th. For our publicity mission to Yankee Stadium, where the only sellouts are the players, I wear my Bill Mazeroski jersey. On the train down, I sit beside an older Yankee fan wearing a Yogi Berra cap. As you'll remember, Yogi was playing left that fateful October day in Forbes Field and watched the Yanks' hopes fly over his head and over the wall. The guy next to me doesn't recognize the jersey, and I think, perhaps uncharitably, that being oblivious of history is a luxury we as Sox fans can't afford. Later at the stadium, in response to the chant, 1918, I turn around and bellow, 1960, and I swear to God, one kid says, "What happened in 1960?
September 19th. The first game of this series was a pulse pounder, which the Red Sox won in their last at-bat. In yesterday's, played under swag-bellied gray skies and in a drizzle that had become a steady rain by the seventh, the Yankees really won it in the first when they tacked a five spot on the tragical Mr. Lowe to the joy of the not-quite-full stadium, not to say the relief. They added four more in the second and were off to the races. By then, Mr. Lowe was gone, suffering from a tragical blow to the ankle, inflicted by ye old horsehide spear. It was, we are told, his earliest exit from a game in 5 years. I wasn't terribly surprised at how poorly he performed. Mr. Lowe is simply having one of those years. As for the Yankees, well, they seem to be making a kind of goal-line stand, this close and no closer, with the this close part being two games. At one point in yesterday's game, it was 13-0 bad guys, and the mostly unremarkable Yankee hurler, John Lieber, took a no-no deep into the game. Before David, I love it when you call me Big Poppy, Ortiz, hit a home run to break up that nonsense. Worst of all, Scribner, who plans to publish this book, had set up an interview with Bob Minzesheimer of USA Today at the ballpark, along with a photographer who took pictures of Stewart and me until every Yankee fan in our immediate vicinity had gotten a good gawk and a chance to boo. Footnote: that would be roughly 7,500, most of them equipped with Yankee hats, Derek Jeter t-shirts, and upturned middle fingers for people wearing Red Sox gear. I have decided that hell is probably an endless photo op in an opposing team's ballpark where your club is getting its fudge packed most righteously to the great glee of the sellout crowd where you are not being allowed to hide like the microbe you would dearly love to be. At last, we were allowed to escape. And could I have written all that yesterday? Technically, yes. It was a Saturday afternoon game, and I had plenty of time later on to jot these fans' notes. Emotionally, no, I was too bummed out. And the bottom line, the ironic bottom line, after all the emotional highs and lows of the last two games, the Boston Red Sox are exactly where they were before coming to New York. Yes, we're 3.5 behind in the AL East, and thanks to an Angels loss to Texas yesterday, we are 5.5 ahead in the wild card. So in the end, it's just two more games off the ever-diminishing schedule. Ah, but this afternoon comes the cherry on the banana split. Martinez versus Mussina, 1:05 p.m. at the stadium. Wonder if I could scalp myself a little ticket to that game. Later. I did, and Pedro was awful. The Red Sox were awful. The New York fans were loathsomely jubilant. I paid $350 for a box seat and watched the Yanks put an 11-1 pounding on my Sox. This afternoon, even the sunshine was awful. It was, in many ways, the apotheosis of the dark side Red Sox fan experience. The Red Sox fan, not as fearless booster of the underdog, but as beaten loser, slinking from the park with his head down, eager to put the sound of those cheering fans behind him, and clinging to the twin tenets of the Manny Ramirez credo for comfort. Turn the page, and we gotta just keep going, man. Tomorrow, Wakefield faces the Birds at Fenway Park. I hope, because I am faithful. I fear, because I know that when you're going bad, you usually get more of the same. The best news is quiet news from the West Coast. The Angels are also weekend losers, and we're still 5.5 games up in the wild card race. On that side of the dance card, it's just two more games off the schedule. But yes, I fear the Orioles, with whom we have gone 1-4 so far this season at Fenway, where we have won so many against other teams.
Today we get our asses kicked again, 11-1, with most of the damage done in an 8-run fifth, as the Yanks chase Pedro. It's humiliating, the kind of loss your friends at school will taunt you about tomorrow. It's also strangely unreal. The Yankees aren't this good, even with performance-enhancing drugs. And we're not this bad. And I have a creeping suspicion that this is payback for Friday night. We, Sox fans, I mean, get the thrilling comeback win, and their fans get the revenge blowouts. Looking back at how Mo blew the save Friday night, walk, hit batsman, missed location, and Sheffield's bad throw, bloop that Lofton for some reason pulls up on, I suspect, at the risk of being paranoid, this is all being orchestrated to ramp up interest on both sides. When a team does nothing to win and still wins, you have to wonder. Of course, 1986's Game 6 is a classic example of that, walk, hit batsman, muffed grounder. Mo also blew the Tech A-Rod game with a gopher ball to Bill Miller, after throwing one to Trot that he just missed. And Mo blew Game 7 of the 2001 series. This fan's got to wonder. The goal would be the dullest but most important of goals, financial security. Obscene TV ratings lead to obscene TV contracts. And who could blame the league? TV money floats the whole show. Just look at the NHL, if you can find them, for the flip side. September 20th. Wake tonight against Baltimore, and there's a sense of letdown, as if these games mean less. It's not true, of course. It's just a byproduct of all the hype and the fact that it's Monday. It's no coincidence that of the six series we play against the Yanks, all but one straddle a weekend. Wake's lost three straight and has looked awful. Tonight he's sharp until the fourth, when he walks a batter, gives up a ground ball single, hits a guy, walks a run in, then surrenders a grand slam to B.J. Surhoff. The O's add three more in the fifth, walking and stealing bases, taking advantage of a passed ball and a blown rundown. And while we chip away late to make the final 8-6, this one was in reach only for one or two at-bats. The Angels win, so they're 4.5 back. Most of the faithful think the wild card's in the bag, but we have problems with the O's and faced them 7 times in our last 13 games. Honestly, I'd rather play the Yankees.
September 21st. I email Stewart. My son Joe says that Derek Lowe and a number of other Red Sox were out partying hardy on Friday night and into the wee hours of Saturday morning under the assumption that the Saturday game, i.e. our game, would be a rainout. Have you heard this? Is it a Sons of Sam Horn thing?
That Lowe rumor, stumbling in at 4 a.m. from the China Club, true or not, points to how unprepared and spacey he looked in the first. I can see the logic. Only someone still half-drunk would have made that throw to third behind Bernie. But look how we played last night after a good night's sleep. That hot streak seems long ago and far away.
Dear Red Sox, it's my birthday, and I'd like you to give me a present. After 3 straight losses, I'd like a win tonight. And with Father Curt on the mound, I think I have a chance of getting one. Even more than a win, I'd like you guys to take stock of your current situation. Do you think you could do that for me? First, since the splendid and cattily crafty win over the Yankees on the 17th, when Red Sox pitching gave up just 2 runs, the Boston staff has given up an average of 11 runs per game. The starters, so good during the August run, have been horrible. Second, Baltimore continues their absolute dominance of the Red Sox, and this had better change. The regular season has now dwindled to a mere 13 games, and 7 of them, the majority in other words, are with these perennial Red Sox killers. Third, the Angels show signs of snapping out of their funk. They won last night, shaving a full game off your wild card lead. You guys had better realize that wild card deal isn't sealed yet. Yes, the Angels have 6 games left against the A's, but we have 3 left against the Yanks. It's time to start winning some damn games against Baltimore. It's been a long time since a sellout Fenway crowd was as quiet as the one last night, especially with the Yankees losing. I think they sense you guys going bad and are waiting, hoping for you to shake it off. So am I. So start tonight with a win, okay? Because after the glory of the last 6 weeks, a September choke would be dismal indeed. Thanking you in advance, Stephen King. 10:35 p.m. Baseball's a funny damn game. I got my birthday present, but it was Red Sox second baseman Mark Bellhorn who gave it to me, after the home plate umpire tried to snatch it away, and after he did snatch away Curt Schilling's 21st win of the season. After 7.5 innings of scoreless baseball, during which Father Curt bagged 14 birds by way of the K, the Red Sox, who have had to struggle far too hard for the 5 or so wins they've managed against the O's this year, manufactured a single skinny run. On came Keith Falk, the Boston closer. He got the first 2 guys, then surrendered a base hit. This brought Sox wrecker Javi Lopez to the plate. Falk, who had never surrendered a hit to Mr. Lopez before tonight, massaged the count to 0-2, then twice he threw clear strikes which the umpire called balls. Footnote. Sorry, Blue, but that slow-mo replay has no mercy. Finally, Falk hung a 2-2 slider that Lopez lost high and gone into the night. In the bottom of the 9th, Boston put runners on 2nd and 3rd with nobody out. My man Kevin Youkilis led the inning with a walk. Then David McCarty popped up and Johnny Damon struck out. Just when I was absolutely convinced that the Sox were going to scuffle to their fourth loss in as many games, this time squandering a brilliant pitching performance in the process, Bellhorn laced a double to right, winning the game and bringing the Sox out of the dugout in a joyous mob of red and white uniforms, while the Standells played and the crowd went bonkers. A little touch of Fenway magic on my birthday. Not bad. And even a little something extra. Tonight we have a magic number in the wildcard race. It's 8. Any combination of Boston wins and Anaheim losses adding up to that number puts us in the postseason.
September 22nd. Nesson, in a strange late-season move, changes the format of their morning sports desk to 30 minutes and replaces beloved Girl Next Door anchor Jamie Parker with heavily coiffed and tailored Hazel May, formerly a post-game analyst, read Talking Head, with the Toronto Blue Jays. In an introductory guest spot between innings with Don and Jerry, she lays down a swinging patter, trying to be chummy and knowledgeable, but comes off as slick and insincere as a game show host, without a touch of irony. She's a pro, no doubt, but her style is wrong for dumpy, low-budget Nesson. We New Englanders distrust fast-talking outsiders. And she's talking mighty fast now, flying out ahead of herself as if she's nervous, as if she suddenly realizes what she's gotten herself into. I can smell the flop sweat through the TV. Don tries to help, feeding her cues to lighten and redirect her spiel. Jerry just stands there, giving her enough rope. I email Steve. What have they done with our Jamie? And with our 15-minute quick-repeating sports desk? Is nothing sacred?
Hazel May? What kind of name is that? And to misquote Bob Dylan, Hazel, you look so hard.
Fulked again. For the second straight night, he gives up a bomb in the ninth to tie the game. This time to the literally hobbling Rafael Palmeiro. We go to extras, where Curtis Laskanik makes us hold our breath before getting out of a bases-loaded jam with an improbable 3-2-4 double play, Pokey alertly covering first. And then Orlando Cabrera, who had a chance to win it in the ninth, but ducked a pitch that would have hit him with bases juiced, knocks one onto the monster for a walk-off and another bouncing celebration at home. I email Steve. Yay, yay, yay.
All's well that ends well. September 23rd. The Birds are making it outrageously hard, and Keith Falk has blown a pair of saves, one with the help of outrageously bad home plate umpiring, 'tis true. But the Red Sox pulled out another one last night. Walk-off home run in the bottom of the 12th. Advantage, Mr. Cabrera. And the Angels dropped another one. The magic number thus drops to 5, and with the Yankees' loss to Toronto and New York's impending weekend visit to our house, even the AL East gold ring seems within our reach. This September still ain't a patch on August, but I'd have to say it's improving. I email Stewart. 5. This magic number brought to you courtesy of the Seattle M's. And by the way, have you checked them crazy Tejas Rangers lately?
Baby, can you dig your Rangers? Dead and buried last week, but after winning 4 straight and going for the sweep of the A's tonight, they're a mere 3 back in the West, and the A's and Angels still have to tangle 6 times. It would be sweet to see the one truly surprising club of this season sneak in on the final weekend. And I'm sure you noticed the milestones last night. El Jefe's 40th homer, and Bellhorn's 163rd K. Just numbers, like 5. Grady Little is no longer the Red Sox manager, ostensibly for his mistrust of the bullpen in an important game. Tonight, new manager Terry Francona shows his faith by resting the hard-ridden Mike Timlin and Keith Falk and letting lefty specialist and submariner Mike Myers pitch to a right-handed hitter with bases loaded and the score tied in the 8th. Then in the 9th, he lets righty specialist and submariner Byung-Hyung Kim pitch to a left-handed batter with 2 on. Bill James, hell, any Strat-O-Matic junkie, could have told you these were low-percentage moves. Francona's trust in his idiotic luck costs us 4 runs, And when Manny gets two of those back in the ninth and David Ortiz's two-out, two-strike blast to right settles into David Newhand's glove, costs us the game. Wake up the talk radio cranks. It's Grady time. A side note. Ellis Burks, who will be retiring after the season, pinch hits in the ninth for what may be his last major league at-bat. When he first came up from Pawtucket in 1987, he was a reedy outfielder just beginning to develop power. Since then, he's ripped over 2,000 hits and 350 home runs. Nifty trivia, he's homered against every club in the majors. This year, he was hurt and wasn't really part of the on-field effort. But he's a clubhouse presence and sentimental favorite. After receiving a warm standing O, Ellis fights B.J. Ryan deep into the count before blooping a single to center. At 40, on creaky knees, he's still a professional hitter. We applaud long and loud as he's lifted for a pinch runner, and he goes into the dugout with a smile. Thanks, Ellis. I get an email from Steve.
We almost took 3 of 4. Poppy came up 4 yards short. Mr. Kim still with the bad karma. My daughter-in-law calls me to ask if it would be all right for her to have Orlando tattooed on her ass. I said sure. And consider, Stu, they could have swept us. Baltimore's the only team in the AL with the nuts to leave Fenway feeling bad about just a split. Holy shit. I'm so glad to see the birds hopping somewhere else, and I feel so bad about having to finish the season back where we started. The great wheel of Ka turns.
If Fran Coma uses the pen by the book tonight, we probably win and take 3 of 4. Seems like he wrote this one off in the 7th with the score tied at 5. What good is the 40-man roster if you don't take advantage of it? Rangers sweep the A's, and we've got a wild-ass race in the West. The magic number remains Nomar.
September 25th. Was there the slightest hitch in Terry Francona's walk last night in the 8th inning, when he finally went out to take the ball from Pedro Martinez's hand, and the boos began raining down from the Fenway faithful? I was sitting in my usual place, just a row up from foul territory between home and first on the Sox side of the field, just about the best seat in the house, and I say there was. If so, such a hitch would indicate surprise. And if Francona was surprised, it would indicate that not even a full season at the helm of this team has taught him the most fundamental thing about the clientele it and he serves. This is no ordinary hardball fan base. The New Englanders who follow the Red Sox are as deeply scarred by loss, particularly loss to the Yankees, as they are loyal to their club. But it's more specific than that. They are especially scarred, traumatized would not be too strong a word, by loss to the Yankees in the late innings with Pedro Martinez, long regarded as the team's ace, on the hill. If Francona cannot grasp that, he cannot succeed in Boston. The Red Sox lost to New York last night 6-4, in spite of home runs by Manny Ramirez, Johnny Damon, and the fiery, not-to-be-denied, Trot Nixon. That they played otherwise with remarkable dullness for a team facing its arch-rival in a last-ditch effort to capture the divisional flag hardly matters, even when you add in the fact that they did it in front of the fans that have loved them so long and so well, if fruitlessly. Love is blind. And most of them will either be back in the park, that would include me and Stuart, or in front of their televisions tonight, rooting for David Ortiz to hit a couple of bombs, and for Orlando Cabrera to make a few more sparkling plays. My scorebook says he made a six-pack of them last night, although he went only 1 for 4 at the plate. We'll find something to cheer. You may depend on it. To a lover, even a smallpox scar is a beauty mark. What we won't forget, and what the newspapers are full of this morning, is Terry Francona leaving Pedro Martinez too long at the fair in a gruesome replay of the 2003 ALCS Game 7. We came into the 8th leading the Yankees 4-3. I think everyone in the park, including Yankee skipper Joe Torre, expected to see Timlin and Embry tag-team that frame while Pedro took his well-earned rest on the bench. But Francona, who apparently never read that thing about how the coach who doesn't learn from the past is condemned to repeat remedial baseball, sent Martinez trudging back out, although the little guy's pitch count was well over 100 by then. The result was what everybody who wasn't asleep expected. Hideki Matsui lost the second pitch he saw, tying the game. Francona, then giving a perfect demonstration of why we stayed in Vietnam as long as we did, left Martinez in to prove he had not made the mistake he had, in fact, made. Williams doubled. Francona still left Martinez in, taking him out only after he had fanned Posada and then given up the go-ahead RBI single to Ruben Sierra. My theory is that if Martinez hadn't gotten at least one out to prove Terry Francona hadn't made a mistake, Martinez might still be in there at 10:30 a.m. the following day, with the score Yanks 949, Sox 4, and blood trickling down from Pedro's burst biceps. But in my fury, I jest. I have serious doubts about Terry Francona's thinking processes, and have all year. There are times when I've thought there's nothing but a bowling alley up there between his ears. But Pedro Martinez is as brilliant as he is brave. After the game, he said in effect, "I can only tip my cap to the Yankees. They've proved they're my daddy." Meaning in baseball vernacular, "They're better than me. They have my number." Martinez knows the chances are quite good that he may not be done with the Yankees even yet, and that if he sees them again, the next game will be exponentially more important than this one. His remark was a way of resetting all the dials to zero. If he does have to face them again, he's lifted a lot of the internal pressure by publicly stating that they can somehow get over, under, or around the best he can do. When and if he takes the mound against the Yankees in postseason, probably in the Bronx, he will be able to tell himself that, based on what he's told the world, he is not the one with something to prove. They are. None of which solves the riddle of why a manager would deliberately go out and replicate a course of action which has already visited defeat and unhappiness on so many in the very recent past. When you think about it, being a Red Sox fan may have quite a lot to teach about what we're doing in Iraq.
At Starfleet Academy, every cadet has to confront the problem of the Kobayashi Maru. The Maru is a freighter caught in a gravity rift in the neutral zone. Cadets naturally respond to its distress calls, but once their starship enters the neutral zone, three Klingon cruisers surround and attack it. The Klingons have overwhelming resources and show no mercy, and the cadet needs to realize he or she is in a no-win situation, that, as Kirk says, there are times when a commander doesn't have the luxury of winning. Red Sox fans don't want to hear that. For all our gloom and doom reputation, we expect to win, and we expect our manager to make the right moves to make that happen. And because we're knowledgeable fans, we know what those moves are before they should take place. Last night, Terry Francona took the Grady test, the Red Sox version of the Kobayashi Maru, and from his solution, it appears he was peeking at Grady's paper. Since the mid-80s, the standard sequence has been get 7 strong from your starter, set up, close. Simple stuff. And the night before, Francona sacrificed a tie game to rest his setup guy and his closer. So there's no excuse for Pedro starting the 8th, or continuing to pitch after Matsui's home run, and we all know it. Once again, the only one who didn't pass the test was the Red Sox manager. And the Angels and Rangers both won, so our magic number remains 5. It's the curse of Nomar.
September 26th. When Yankee starting pitching goes south, as Roger Clemens' replacement Javier Vasquez did last night in the 5th inning, Joe Torre now has essentially 2 choices in the matter of middle relief. Tom Gordon, whose loss from the Red Sox I understand and accept but still lament in my heart, and the Bronx Delicatessen Brigade. Having used Gordon to get to Rivera in the first game of this late-season Yanks-Sox series, Torre was stuck with the Deli Brigade last night. After Vasquez came Tanyan Sturts. After Sturts came Heredia. And lo, Heredia begat Quantrill, and Quantrill begat Nitkowski. So too did Nitkowski begat Proctor, also called Scott. By that time, the Yankees were pretty well baked, and the usually crafty Quantrill left in far too long last night. Footnote. Ah, but under the circumstances, the always crafty Joe Torre really had little choice. By then it was a fool's mate. Took the loss by default. This was a good night to be at the ballpark and a good game for the Red Sox to win. Although the Angels and the Rangers, now tied for wild card runners-up and nipping at the heels of the Athletics in the AL West, both won their games, we reduced our magic number for clinching a playoff berth to 3. Better yet, we have made it impossible for the Yankees to clinch this year's AL East flag on ground taxed by the state of Massachusetts. Best of all, at least for the head sitting beneath the bright red Yankees hater hat I see in the mirror, is this. No matter how we do against our longtime nemesis this Sunday afternoon, in 2004's last regular season game at Fenway Park, we will have won the 19-game season series. The worst we can do is 10-9, and if Father Curt is on his game, it will be 11-8. This isn't as good as it could have been, especially for a team that was at one point 6-1 against the Pinstripers. But when it comes to the Yankees, we take our satisfactions where we can get them. 7 p.m. It's by no means a sure thing that the Red Sox and Yankees will meet in the ALCS for the second year in a row. I am sure that baseball stat wizards like Bill James will tell you it's odds against, given the fact that the opening postseason series are nasty, brutish, and short. Footnote, 3 out of 5 rather than 4 out of 7. But given the level of competition between the two clubs this season, I have to believe that such an American League championship series would be a boon to that larger faithful that loves not just the Red Sox or the Yankees, but the game itself. Last weekend at Yankee Stadium, the Sox won a close one Friday night and then endured 2 shellackings to the glee of packed stadium crowds. At the Fens this weekend, it was the Yankees winning a close one Friday night and the Red Sox winning the 2 weekend games by lopsided scores, today's final being 11-4, with a woefully unready for primetime Kevin Brown taking the loss and not escaping the first inning. At Yankee Stadium, the joint resounded to sarcastic choral cries of Pedro, Pedro, as Martinez left his game on the mound. Today at Fenway Park, the cry was Jeter, Jeter, as the New York shortstop flubbed a potential double play and then made way for a pinch hitter in the 8th, after going 1 for a dozen, .083, over the 3 games. In the end, Boston took the season 11-8. But in the crucial run scored category, there was in the end almost no difference. 106 for the Sox, 104 for the Yanks. When you think about 171 innings of baseball, excluding games that may have gone beyond the regulation 9, that's an amazingly small margin, hardly more than a coat of paint. In terms of playing into October, the team's job is now clear-cut, if slightly complicated by Gene, the 4th hurricane to strike Florida in the last 5 weeks. Of the 7 games remaining on the regular season schedule, the Red Sox need to win only a pair to assure themselves of a postseason berth. Another and more meaningful meeting with the Yankees may or may not lie ahead. In the meantime, let Trot Nixon, Boston's rejuvenated right fielder, have the final word on this exhaustive and exhausting regular season slate of Red Sox-Yankees matchups. 19 is too many, he said flatly in a post-game interview this afternoon. We've seen everything they've got, and they've seen what we've got. I don't mind playing them, but 19 is just too many.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome once again to Super Pro Wrestling. For no other reason than he doesn't like the way Doug Monkiewicz is standing on the bag at first, or might it have something to do with Lofton's mysterious ejection during the Tech A-Rod brawl, Kenny Lofton deliberately elbows him as he goes by, on a play that isn't close, in a game that's a runaway. Maybe Kenny's frustrated, or just dumb, because he seems surprised, nay, outraged, when reliever Pedro Astacio throws behind him late in the game. The next inning, the Yanks' kid reliever throws at Dave Roberts' head. Uncool, and Roberts is justifiably pissed. There's a huge difference between throwing behind a guy and throwing at his head, and everyone in the game knows it. Likewise, if you purposely elbow someone, you had better expect to be thrown at. In both cases, the Yankees broke the unwritten code. If there's any justice, and wrestling is all about poetic justice, the game will make them pay. Side note, today's sellout was our 81st of the year. Only three other clubs in the history of baseball have sold out their entire home season. All three were playing in brand new stadiums. Footnote, the Indians at Jacobs Field, the Rockies at Coors, and the Giants at Pac Bell.
September 27th. Hurricane Jean has knocked out the electricity in the Tampa Bay area, and for a while, it looks as if the game may not be played. The juice is restored, but someone seems to have neglected to tell the Boston bats. Or maybe it's just young Scott Kazmir exerting the sort of limited but malign influence certain pitchers seem able to cast over certain teams. When Kazmir faced Martinez 2 weeks ago, you'll recall, he won easily. He seems well on his way to a second win tonight, striking out batter after batter, Kevin Millar, on egregiously high cheese. So when my youngest son, up on a wonderful extended visit from New York, suggests we turn off the game and go to a movie, I agree at once, even though the Sox technically have a chance to clinch a playoff berth. I now believe they will clinch. I just don't believe it will be tonight.
The code is absolute and beyond partisanship. Tonight, Bronson Arroyo hits Aubrey Huff unintentionally with a curve that breaks down and in too sharply. No big deal, even though it puts Huff out of the game with a bruised shin. But then, a batter later, with men on second and third and first base open, Bronson drills Tino Martinez in the back, and Tino rightfully has some things to say. Former Mets phenom Scott Kazmir, who has yet to give up a hit, retaliates, hitting Manny low. And Manny's cool, Manny understands, and hoofs it down to first without a word. Now that things are evened up, the ump warns both dugouts. Any more of this and both the pitcher and the manager are going. But Kazmir, maybe on Lou Piniella's orders, isn't done. He hits the very next batter, Millar, in the ribs. Millar takes exception and the bench is clear briefly. Goodbye, unhittable Kazmir, goodbye, Lou. It's a foolish move. We jump all over reliever Jorge Sosa for 5 runs, including a drive to dead center by Manny that lands on the roof of the fancy restaurant out there, and go on to win 7-3 and clinch the wild card. See? That's what happens when you go against the code. And ironically, since being on the same team overrides the code, during the locker room celebration, Manny hugs Terry Adams, who he came close to charging back in April after a little chin music.
It's the late show of the Forgotten we go to. And in Bethel Station on a Monday night, my son and I are 2 of just 6 attendees. As we're leaving, the guy cleaning up behind the candy counter tells me, casually, that the Red Sox were leading Tampa Bay by a score of 7-2, and he thinks that might be a final. Owen and I look at each other in delighted amazement, then hurry to his car and tune the radio to WOXO, Norway, South Paris, which advertises itself as everybody's country, when, that is, they're not broadcasting NASCAR racing, Boston Red Sox baseball, or Oxford Hills High School football. We discover that the game has indeed ended and that the final score was 7-3. Bronson Arroyo hit a couple of batters. He leads the American League in that category. And Scott Kazmir retaliated. The umpires let him get away with drilling Manny Ramirez in the knee, but when Kazmir whacked Kevin, I break for high cheese Millar in the ribs, the kid was gone, taking an incipient no-hitter with him. Footnote. For the record, I think that hitting Millar was an accident, but accident or on purpose, Kazmir did the Boston batters one hell of a favor by dealing himself out. 3 or 4 home runs later, Manny hit number 43, the 2004 Red Sox party boys are in a clubhouse so wrapped in plastic it looks like a condom, laughing and shouting and pouring beer on each other. They all acknowledge that the regular season isn't over as long as catching the Yankees remains a technical possibility. By winning, the Red Sox cut the lead of the idle Yanks to 3 games, and in that light, the 2 we lost to the awful Albertos during the last homestand look bigger than ever. But in their raucous celebrating, there is an undeniable sense that they feel the real work is now done. Given their lackluster level of play in June and July, that is understandable. In some ways, they are lucky to be here at all. I get an email from Stuart.
The Sox are sudsing Manny with champagne. I'm toasting them with ginger ale. I've got a bottle of bubbly downstairs, but I'm saving it for something bigger. Still, to make the playoffs with the injuries we've had, I'm proud of this club. They gave us a great summer. The punchline, now for a great fall. Looks like Minnesota and the great Santana. I'd match him up with Schilling. Just go after him. Too bad those games will be on the road.
Mathematically, it was the weirdest clinch ever.
What Steve means is that we didn't whittle our magic number down to 0. We're still at 1, but because our competition for the wild card is Anaheim, that 1 assumes they win the rest of their games, 3 of which are against Oakland, who they're only 1 game behind now. And if they do that, they win the West, and Oakland becomes our already defeated competition. So our wish from a few months ago has come true. The A's and Angels knock each other off without even playing the games. Thank you, unbalanced schedule, and unbalanced schedule makers. The rest of our games are most likely meaningless, but it's like Jim Carrey says in Dumb and Dumber when Lauren Holly tells him the odds of them being together are more like 1,000,000 to 1. So you're telling me there's a chance. Start carving your playoff roster. We're going to the show. September 28th. Tonight's game against Tampa Bay is an audition for pitchers on the bubble. Derek Lowe pitches dreadfully, scuttling his chance to be the number 3 starter in the playoffs. Bronson Arroyo seems to have won that spot with his strong second half. Terry Adams throws 2+ ugly innings, so count him out. By the time Alan Embry comes in to throw 1 shutout inning, it's 8-8. Scott Williamson, who's been injured, walks 1 guy in his stint, but his velocity is still down around 89, so I doubt he'll make the roster. Pedro Astacio's just getting some work in before he starts half of Saturday's doubleheader in Baltimore. Ramiro Mendoza, though, nails his assignment, pitching a perfect 9th and 10th, striking out 2, and giving us a chance to win it when Kevin Millar cranks a 2-run shot off fireballing closer Danis Baez, who Lou has left out there throwing 96, and then 94, 93, 92, for 3 innings. Fulk crafts a 1-2-3 11th, and we're 2.5 back of the Yanks with 5 to go. Much more exciting is the West, where the Angels and A's are now in a dead heat with a 3-game showdown looming on the season's final weekend, the results of which will determine the playoff matchups. Right now, the Central champs, the Twins, have a better record, by a mere 1 win, than Oakland and Anaheim, meaning they'd play us and have home field advantage. And the Yankees would host whoever won the West, an easier task given the Twins' brilliant lefty Johan Santana. The Yanks have some control over the situation. Tomorrow, they start a 3-game series against the Twins. They can avoid Santana by rolling over for them, but that's a risk. If they lose too many, we have a shot at catching them. Slim, sure, but a shot.
September 29th. I email Stuart. Today is a big day. If we win and Minnesota sweeps, it could happen. 1 chance in 4. Meet me at Foxwoods.
I know, I'm thinking the same way. But I read in the paper this morning that Francona and Wallace have decided not to change the playoff rotation to go after the division. That is, they'll still throw Astacio versus the O's in that doubleheader. The Coma himself. At the chance of sounding like I don't care, because I do, I'm sort of going to be stubborn about screwing our pitching up. I love the idea of having home field advantage. I also think that you win with pitching. We're going to somewhat try to remember that. And as things shape up, it appears Pedro's slated for Game 1, and therefore Game 5, and Schill for Game 2, and thus Game 1 of the ALCS. So forget that dream matchup of Schilling Santana. I guess Terry thinks we can split with Santana and take Schill's start. Or maybe he's hoping we'll outslug them at home for our number 3 and 4. Call me the tumbling dice.
I guess Terry thinks. You're giving him too much credit. Your news is unbelievable. The scenario you describe is idiotic. All I can hope is that Francona will change his mind and see reason if Minnesota sweeps New York. They lead in the first game 3-1 in the middle innings, and we beat Tampa Bay again. Given the last couple of weeks, his plan to start Pedro in Game 1 is also foolish. His inexperience is showing, not to mention a certain ochre tinge running up the center of his back. I'm disgustipated, to quote Sylvester the Cat. Could these be orders from above? Sigh. Probably not.
Since we're 2.5 back with 5 to go, I can almost understand the thinking. Almost. Last year, we could have run the table if we'd had home advantage. And did you see who's sitting behind home plate at Yankee Stadium right now? Scouting both the Yanks and Twins for the Cubbies? That's right, Mr. Grady Little.
I'm back in Maine rather than at Fenway Park or at Yankee Stadium, where a sparse crowd is watching the rare afternoon game. But I'm once more wearing my bright red Yankees hater cap, and for a perfectly good reason. The sparse stadium crowd is in attendance at the first of this year's last three really important games. Two between the Twins and the Yankees, one between the hapless Devil Rays and the Red Sox. The Minnesota Twins, represented on the mound in the first of these crucial tilts by Johan Santana, who will almost certainly win this year's Cy Young Award in the American League, are leading 3-1 in the fifth inning. If the Twins go on to win this game, Santana hasn't lost since the All-Star break, plus the nightcap of this hurricane-induced doubleheader, and if the Red Sox can win tonight in Tampa, footnote, it would be their fifth win in a row, the Yankees' lead in the AL East would drop to a single, scrawny game. I'm not saying this will happen, but if it did, considering the fact that Boston and New York have a combined total of 8 games left to play, well, in a case like that, all bets would be off. Maybe it doesn't matter. Probably it doesn't matter in terms of what comes next. Once you get to postseason, all the matchups are tough. But I want that home field advantage. Even more, I'd like to see the Yankees humbled. So come on, you Twins. Go, you Johan.
It's weird. Here we have the Yanks ace, Moose, against Johan Santana in a rematch of last year's ALDS, in a game with playoff implications. Yet when I tune in during the second inning, I discover the stadium is a sea of blue seats. There can't be more than 2,000 people there. Less than the number of folks who turn out for BP at Fenway. Later, the Yankees will list the official attendance as NA, not available. Hey, George, I hear Montreal's looking for a team.
10:15 p.m. One doesn't like to believe God is a Yankees fan. It's a terrifying idea. But days like this make me wonder. I thought that, with New York playing 2 against a strong Minnesota team and the Red Sox playing 1 against the hapless Rays, we really had a chance to pull within a breath of first place. At worst, I thought, New York would split their twin bill with Santana taking the opener. But no. Santana left after 5 with a 3-1 lead, pulled by the Twins' skipper, who quite naturally wants to protect his young ace with the playoffs looming. The Yankees then scored a bazillion runs, and the camera caught the aforementioned young ace in the dugout hucking helmets at the cement floor, getting quite a bounce, too. The Yankees went on to win the second game 5-4. In Tampa, Tino Martinez hit a 3-run bomb to put the game out of reach in the 8th. But the really disturbing development was how mortal Pedro Martinez looked in his last start of the regular season. How downright lousy. The hapless D-Rays won that one 9-4, and instead of picking up a game and a half, we lost a game and a half. The Yankees' margin is now 4 games, and given that the Red Sox have just 4 to play, I think that pretty well cooks us in the AL East, don't you? The bottom line is simply that when the pressure got really intense, the Yankees refused to buckle. The Red Sox, aided by the Baltimore Orioles, and at times by Terry Francona, who has a tendency to freeze at critical moments like Captain Queeg in the Kane Mutiny, did. Now we turn our eyes, ever hopeful, ever faithful, to the playoffs, where we can only hope the script will change. I email Stewart. Santana comes out of the game, the Yanks score 4 and win. And I saw Santana in the dugout heaving helmets. It ain't nothing to Gardenhire. He's got a lock. If we finish second, I have no problem with Tito's doubleheader pitching roster. But what's with this playoff skid? Are we conceding the game Santana pitches or what? Saving Curt for winnable games? Give me your thinking on this. What am I not seeing here?
I thought the Yanks might tank it to make sure we'd get the Twins. But now it appears the Twins tanked it, pulling Santana after 5. The playoffs don't start for another 6 days, so it's not like a starter should be on a pitch count around 70. Boo! I have no idea what's up with T. Frank's playoff rotation. It sounds like he's going with a 4-man squad, meaning Curt will start only game 2 of the ALDS. I guess he's assuming that's a W, and he'll have his number 3 and 4 guys set for games 3 and 4 at Fenway. If the 3 and 4 guys and the home bats can't get it done, then he's hoping, someday, some way, for a split between Pedro and Santana. Problem is, Arroyo, who should be our number 3, has thrown far better on the road, and at this point we don't have a reliable number 4. I think it's cavalier of Francona to assume we don't need 2 from Father Curt in the first round. Sure, it'd be nice to start the ALCS with a fresh ace, but there's not much margin for error in this plan. Minnesota's a good team that's been there before. September 30th. I email Steve. So was the Comas' initial rotation just smoke? Because now Pedro's saying he's starting game 2 and Shill's taking games 1 and 5. And the Angels, now leading the West by 1, have the exact same record as the Twins. I have to wonder, is the switch due to the possibility of missing Santana? It's all up in the air for now, and probably will be until the outcome of that juicy Angels at A's series this weekend.
I don't know about the rotation. All I know for sure is that I'm considering a petition to the great high Ayatollah, suggesting a fatwa on the Yankees would be a good idea. October 1st. As a Red Sox fan, I am, of course, aware that there is another baseball league. But my grasp of it is vague, like a European's grasp of the New World in the 17th century, or an American's grasp of the solar system in the 19th. Yes, somewhere in the American Midwest there lives a fearsome, wand-wielding wizard named Pujols. And I know that in California there be giants, for my Red Sox did truly visit them once in the season which is now almost over. But like most Red Sox fans, my focus will remain fiercely fixed on what is sometimes called the junior circuit, until and if we have to play one of those quasi-mythological others in the World Series. And that's okay, because in this final weekend of regular season baseball, I find plenty to occupy me within the familiar geography of the American League. 3 of the 4 AL postseason teams have now been decided. The Yankees, AL East champs, the Twins, AL Central champs, and the Red Sox, AL wildcard. The winner in the AL West will be decided this weekend in Oakland, when the A's and Angels, with identical 90 and 69 records, go head-to-head. It will be, in effect, a mini-playoff, one the Red Sox and their fans will be watching with great interest. We'll play the team out of our division with the best record. But as I write this on Friday afternoon, Minnesota's record is also 90 and 69. That means we could wind up facing any one of those 3. All I know for sure is that I'm hoping Cleveland will put a hurtin' on Minnesota this weekend, because we have to start by playing 2 away games no matter who our opponent is. Given that, I would prefer to steer clear of the Metrodome as long as possible, not to mention young Mr. Santana.
The Sox had last night off, ceding center stage, at least here in the East, to the Yankees, who clinched the division with their 100th win. So that's, what, 16 against Tampa, 15 against Baltimore, 14 against Toronto, beating the Twins' second-line relievers late after Ron Gardenhire pulled starter Brad Radke in the 5th. By resting, in effect, the Twins rolled over this whole series, handing the Yanks the sweep. With the Angels losing and the A's winning, the West is knotted again, and the Twins, Angels, and A's all share the same record. Because the Angels and A's play each other this weekend, the winner of the West will have at least 92 wins. The Twins lost their season series with both clubs, so to face the Sox, they have to sweep their last three. I have to wonder, by losing this series, are the Twins purposely shooting for a rematch with the Yanks? October 2nd. Last night, the Angels humbled the A's 10-0 at home. And today, they come back late against setup guy Ricardo Rincon and new closer Octavio Dotel to win the West. Choklund has done it again. Billy Bean, you are not a genius. With no defense, no small ball, and no pen, and ace Mark Mulder denying an obvious hip problem, the A's went into a September-long swoon that their fans will taste for the entire offseason. The Angels, missing Adam Kennedy with a knee injury and suspending Jose Guillen for throwing his helmet and dissing manager Mike Socha, overcame everything to beat their rivals at the wire. The Cubs, who had a two-game lead in the NL wildcard a week ago, eliminate themselves by losing their sixth in seven games, including three blown saves by high-priced free agent closer LaTroy Hawkins, and crucial home losses to cellar dwellers, the Mets and the Reds. On the home front, the Sox sweep a meaningless doubleheader from the O's, something we could never do when the games really counted. Mr. Kim picks up a garbage win. Ellis Burks plays in his 2000th and most likely last game, adding a single to his career stats. Afterward, Terry Francona announces that Arroyo and Wake will start in the playoffs and that Lowe won't. Lowe leaves the clubhouse without a comment. And in the postgame, X says, "Will Derek Lowe be back next year? Who cares?" And we still don't know who we're playing in the division series.
I continue to believe that it was our play against Baltimore, identified in my game notes from July on as the LEBs, footnote, loathsome Albertos, that cost us the AL East. Now that that little matter has been decided, we're doing all right against the LEBs, having already guaranteed ourselves at least a split in the season's final, meaningless four-game series. Please note that they has once again become we, and will now likely stay that way, for better or worse, until the season ends. On the West Coast, the Athletics have suddenly and rather shockingly come unglued. Anaheim beat them last night 10-0, and came from behind to beat them again today 5-4. So the Angels win the West, and all the AL postseason teams are now decided. The only remaining question is who the Red Sox will draw in the first round, the Angels or the Twins. Today's game between Minnesota and Cleveland would have settled that issue if Cleveland had won. But the game was suspended in the 11th with the score tied 5-5, so the groundskeepers could prepare the field for a University of Minnesota football game. Say what? I email Stewart. Regular season's most surreal touch, Minnesota-Cleveland game, which would have nailed down the final playoff locale, suspended for a college football game. Beautiful.
Go Golden Gophers! Shades of last year's All-Star game. Imagine if you were in the crowd at the Metrodome. Come back tomorrow? Hell no!
October 3rd. It's the last day of the regular season, and in the majors, the last few games are being played out by the subs, scrubs, and in a few cases, the stars of tomorrow. In Chicago, disconsolate Cubs fans are telling each other without much real hope that next season may be better. On the South Side, the Chi Sox fans gave up on this season long ago. In Tampa, Lou Piniella has packed away his horrible, snot-green pullover for another season and bid his hapless Devil Rays adieu. In Baltimore, the baseball writers have already begun beating the MVP tom-tom on behalf of Miguel Tejada. But given what Gary Sheffield's done for the Yankees and what Manny Ramirez has done for the Red Sox, I don't give them much of a chance. In Texas, the plotting has already begun to turn this year's AL West dark horse into next year's favorite. In Oakland, Wunderkind Billy Bean may, like Lucy Arnaz, have some splainin' to do. In Toronto, the Wunderkind disciples of Billy Bean have probably left their offices for the year only after dropping their cell phones into their shredders. And in Minnesota, the last playoff question was answered late this afternoon, when the Indians came up with two insurance runs in the top of the ninth and beat the Twins 5-2. Thus, it's Minnesota opening against New York on the East Coast and Boston opening against Anaheim on the West, both the day after tomorrow. I'll be at Fenway for the third game of the Sox-Angels series, and for the fourth if needed. It probably will be. My heart beats a little faster just writing that. At this point, everything gets magnified, because when the second season ends, it does so either with shocking suddenness or, could it be, with a sort of success of which Red Sox fans hardly dare dream.
The Twins win the resumption of their suspended game, but then lose to the Indians, making the last Angels-A's game meaningless, though no less painful to those A's fans who bothered to show up. We lose our last game to the O's. McCarty throws two scoreless, striking out three, and finish 98-64, our best record since 1978. Manny wins the home run and slugging crowns. Schilling has the best one loss, though it appears the MVP will now go to Vladimir Guerrero for his big September, while Santana should take the Cy Young. Ichiro breaks George Sisler's all-time record for hits in a season, but coming for a last-place club, and most of them being singles, it doesn't wow serious fans. He's just the new Rod Carew. And the Astros win their final game, snatching the NL wild card from Barry Bonds and the Giants. It's still possible we'll see Roger Clemens in the World Series. I email Steve. So we've got Anaheim and the Twins get their wish. I really think they orchestrated the last week, tanking all three to the Yanks, losing to Cleveland today, to get a rematch with the Yanks in the short series, figuring it's easier to get them here than in the ALCS. Gardenhire's no dummy.
Footnote. Nah, it's just a common sports malady, choking disease. October 4th. I email Stuart. If we can get past the Angels, I think the World Series may be ours.
I'm having the same grandiose bubbles-in-the-blood thoughts, and rightfully. It's a whole new season. Hope springs eternal. So who's going to be left off the playoff roster? It's like spring training, all these guys vying for the very last spots. For the pitchers, I take Mendoza over Laskanik, Williamson, and Adams. He's been more consistent. Laskanik can get wild, Williamson's not 100%, and Adams stinks. And who gets the nod for the last position player, McCarty or Minkiewicz? I'm for McCarty. More pop, just as good a glove, and he's got the arm to play the outfield in a pinch. I think we've got to keep Kapler, Roberts, and Pokey for D and speed, and Uke for a stick off the bench, but management might surprise me. As a Rock Cats fan, I want to believe in the Twins. I like that they're going right after them. But if the Yanks can beat Santana just once, or closer Joe Nathan in one of those starts, they're cooked. My hope is they split in the stadium, then turn on that Metrodome Jetstream air conditioning and let thermodynamics do the rest.
I'm for Mankiewicz mostly because I finally learned how to spell his name. Actually, because he's just gotten hot at the plate. I like Curtis the mechanic because I think he's clutch, and I don't think Mendoza is. And in the end, in the pen, it's going to come down to the tragical Mr. Lowe. I hope we don't have to depend on him too much. The guy I really want to see on that roster, but may not, is the Greek god of walks.
Yep, as in last year's division series, our fate may rest in the shaky hands of Mr. Lowe. But that's the playoffs. Maximum stress finding the weakest link.